Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
This is In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time. And welcome to the podcast. The New Orleans Pelicans decided that Michael McNamara should defeat me in our predictions and go 1-1 rather than 2-0, like I said. I don't know why on earth I would say 2-0, because, of course, this team has a majorly losing record, and we never have anything nice. That's why Anthony Davis had to sit out half that game. It was just dumb on my part, isn't it?
It could have happened. I mean, they could have won or lost either game this week. So
optimism bias.
It's just safe to play it down the middle with this team. So just pick 1-1 every set of two games.
Okay. Well, yeah. No, that sounds terrible. I'm gonna continue to be optimistic. Optimism bias. I'm going for it. But yeah, they were in the game in against Toronto, couldn't pull it out at the very end after Davis went out halfway through the game. And then they had an overtime win in Charlotte, just in a vacuum. Which of these two games did you enjoy more? The one that we saw mostly Anthony Davis, or the one we saw mostly DeMarcus Cousins?
I would say the Charlotte game, but it wasn't because of the stars in either game. To me, I just enjoy this team infinitely more when the role players don't play like hot pieces of trash. And we saw it in Charlotte. Like, to me, it's not really rocket science how this team goes from, you know, average or a little below average to a quality team. And it's not really Davis. It's not really Cousins. It's not even them playing well together. It's just have two or three role players not be trash, and all of a sudden you could compete in any game. And that's what we got here with Solomon Hill. Had little stretches where he was hot. Dante Cunningham, you know, goes 6 for 7. And then Michael Jordan Crawford just goes off for 19 points on 12 shots. So, I mean, to me, that's why I enjoyed this one more, is because I can't stand to watch a game, even when we have Davis and Cousins clicking on all cylinders, which has actually happened once or twice since they got together. I can't stand watching the games where they kick it out to these guys and watch them dribble out of bounds or, you know, just fire up air balls or bricks. So I enjoyed the Charlotte game because I saw a couple of other guys who didn't look like D-leaguers.
Yeah, it's almost as if you get 3 points from Solomon Hill, that's bad. And if you get 16 points from Solomon Hill, that's good. It is kind of, how is he so hot and cold? Have you ever watched and said, oh, this is about an average Solomon Hill game? Like, every time I watch and I even notice that he's on the court, I'm like, either, hey, Solomon Hill's doing good things, and they're awesome, or it's like, God, he is so bad.
It's not just him. Like, him and Dante combined to go 13 for 18 in this game, and then just the game before, they combined to go 4 for 12, including 1 of 6 from 3. Like, I mean, you're talking about 30 points versus 9 between these two guys playing the small forward position or whatever you want to call them. Like, it's just such a drastic difference from game to game with, you know, a lot of guys on this team, and usually they're the poor version of themselves. So, yeah, that's why I enjoyed this game, and, you know, it was interesting to hear the takes after the Pelicans win yet another game in which, I mean, the three games that they have won since Cousins came over, he was not on the court at the end of the game, including one game in which he didn't play at all. So, you know, of course, the Twitterverse starts going and one person mentions that and then everybody piles on. But, let's throw the wins and losses aside and let's just talk about how they're playing. Are you concerned at all any more, you know, for the long term than you were versus where you were on February 20th? Is there any more doubt in your head today than there was immediately after the trade that, you know, maybe these two guys and this franchise with these two guys will just never quite figure it out?
So I would be lying if I said no, but it's all around just one thing, and it's Cousins being in better shape. And, you know, you keep saying we're in a honeymoon period. I think I said once a long time ago when there were rumors about trading for Cousins out there and we brought it up, that I said, you know, you're going to have a year of Cousins where he's just going to want to prove that he's not a problem, and he's going to do what he can to prove that he's a winner. I don't know how much past that point it'll last. But if he comes in and he starts next season and he's in this shape, it's not going to work great, because you're going to have situations, because this is the modern NBA, where if Cousins is unable to guard either a roll man on a pick and roll, or at least chase a stretch for a little bit, he's not going to be playable at the end of the fourth quarter against some of these teams, and against most of the teams that you will be actually wanting to play against in the playoffs. Like, there's no way you could play him against Cleveland or Golden State or, like, you know, a lot of the top tier teams, the Clippers even. It would be hard to do. So I don't know. That's my one take on it. What do you think? Do you watch Cousins and think this could be kind of fun?
Well, I mean, I'd like to flip it the other way of, you know, the thing that's caught me since he's been here is that he's been in foul trouble in seemingly almost every game, you know, and I know he was a guy who picked up fouls, but, you know, he's fouling out or coming close to fouling out at a pace that would exceed Sacramento. So I wanted to, you know, go and try to look at a couple of things. And basically my conclusion is, because they didn't have much better, if, you know, probably not at all better perimeter defenders. But the reason why he wasn't fouling out as much and his fouls per 36 or fouls per 100 possessions were down about 20% versus what they were in New Orleans were two reasons. One, he played a lot more power forward in Sacramento, so you had another guy like Kufos or somebody like that by the rim as the last line of the defense taking those fouls. And then the other is that they just played at a slower pace. So to me, if your goal is to maximize Cousins, and you really want to get the best out of them you can, you would say, all right, we probably have to play at a slower pace. When we stagger him and Anthony, it'd probably be best if we had a center playing with Cousins. And then, you know, just overall with the slower pace, you know, it would probably make a little more sense to play inside out. So, you know, if you're thinking of just maximizing Cousins and keeping him out of foul trouble and it not really mattering that much that he's in the greatest shape of his life, you would probably go to a different system. And this is where I just keep coming back to, again, if you had this roster and no coach, you would not seek out a guy like Alvin Gentry this summer. And I don't want to get into the simpleton stuff of his career record and all this nonsense, because he also showed you that he could overachieve with a team that has a roster that is built for him. I just want to get into the simple fit, and I think Alvin Gentry is a very good offensive mind. But again, if this was my roster heading into the summer, there's no, and I had no coach, there's no way I would seek out a guy like Gentry. So I don't get it, because I just think with a pace like this and playing like this, even if they figure out things scheme-wise next year, Boogie's going to get into foul trouble a lot, and he's never going to be in the type of shape he really needs to be in to play at that pace.
Well, so then what's the what do you want them to do in this offseason? Like, I mean, say Dell sticks around or not. It doesn't matter. Dell is going to have the same decision in front of him that he had, you know, when I guess they felt like expectations weren't being met under Monty Williams. Would you fire Gentry? Or do you think that's a bad message to send to Cousins and it doesn't, or what do you think?
So here's my thing, is like, when you really break down this argument, we could say, well, you know, if you fire Gentry and hire another coach, it, you know, doesn't look good. Well, unless that coach comes in and does really well, in which case, you know, that's not going to look bad at all. So really what you're saying is, I don't trust myself to fire this coach and find the right next head coach. And if that's the case, you shouldn't be in any position of power whatsoever. If you don't believe in your ability to identify and hire people. So I guess that's my thing. If you know that this guy is not the right coach, and again, not that he's a bad coach. Frank Vogel, with his type of players, is a good coach, and without his types of players is a bad coach, you know, if you're just that much of a simpleton. So I'm not saying he's a bad coach, but he's bad for this roster. And if you know that, and your only reason for not firing him is because you're afraid that you're going to get the next hire wrong and then Boogie's going to bolt, then you should not be in a position of authority whatsoever if that's the way you think, if you're that fear-based. So, I would suggest that if they think as I do, and I can't see how you see it any differently, that they should find another coach this summer.
Okay. I mean, I can't disagree, but then I think the whole front office should be cleaned out, so
With my general premise, I mean, don't you think that this roster, for a myriad of reasons, just screams a lower, I mean, you should be in the lower 10 in pace. You should be a team that's somewhere between maybe 20 and 30. I mean, yeah. Okay.
So they're especially with when I went back and I did the, I think it was like a 7 or 8 things to know about the Pelicans back, you know, a couple months ago. The fastest people on that list, amongst the top 4, was Buddy Hield and Langston Galloway and Shake Diallo, who didn't really play much, but those are like the 3 fastest guys. So we traded away 2 of our most open court players that were guards, and we were left with this team. Like, Hill was the only one in the top 5 that's still on this team. think the other one I think was Lance Stephenson. So why there is nobody fast on this team. So other than maybe Tim Frazier, who likes to get out into the open court and run a little bit, but he can't finish. Like, who else would you want to be running on this team? Like, if I told you, hey, you have a running team, you've got your three superstars already, and you know you have the Golden State Big Three sitting on your roster, and you want to play fast, who are you taking from this team? Anyone? You could have anyone.
Michael Jordan Crawford.
Okay. I mean, like, Anthony Davis is actually the slowest guy on that list. He was slower than Omer Asik.
Yeah.
Like, this team should be not running out. I mean, and of course, also, it's now a power team. This is the first time I've seen a real power team that I've rooted for. There's so much stuff going on in the trenches. And so many, like, arms and lockups and things like that. We just don't see it very often. And it's generally because both Davis and Cousins now at this point are physically stronger than the guys guarding them at almost all times. Because Davis is always against the power forward and Cousins is always against the center, and they're bigger, stronger dudes. And so the only thing they have left is to try to shove them around and lock things up and hold them and do all the dirty tricks that you can to try to get these guys into foul trouble. So do you like that kind of play? So when you see Cousins in there pushing people around and he gets his arms locked up and he's flailing, do you enjoy that? Do you think that's kind of fun?
It always makes me nervous because I feel that it's more likely that they're going to call a foul on the guy on my team than the other team, just because, I mean, again, I think anybody who listens to this pod knows I'm not a homer whatsoever, but I do get why Cousins is so frustrated. He is officiated by seemingly a different set of rules than everybody else, so I would rather him just not be caught up in that, because I guess I always just assume the whistle's going to go against him. But, I just think it should be slow. And again, just going back to this foul trouble, Cousins is, you know, at his highest fouls per 36 minutes, per 100 possessions, whatever, since his rookie year, when, you know, every rookie big who comes in the league is just a big, dumb, flailing oaf who, you know, picks up fouls left and right. And it's just gone up again and again. You're playing at a faster pace. He's a little more tired, so he's sloppy. He's playing center, so he's the last line of defense. All of these things are just factoring into, you know, halfway through the first quarter, he's got two fouls, and now you got to manage his minutes the rest of the game, and it's just not a fit, and I can't ever see this being a successful up-tempo team. And if you're going to go slow or slower, could Gentry do it? Yeah, but why are you going to try to make that fit when there's so many other people who could just want to play that style naturally? So I just don't get it. And the only argument is that, well, you don't want to look like a incompetent franchise to Cousins. Well, then hire the right freaking coach and then have that guy come in and help you win games, and Cousins will have long forgot about Alvin Gentry.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my take all along, was, you know, either this team is going to win or it's going to lose next year, and that is going to weigh more heavily on DeMarcus Cousins' mind when it comes time to decide if he's staying or he's going than anything about, oh, they fired another coach. It's all winning or losing. Now, if they don't hire a new coach, and like we get to game 15 and already the team is having trouble and then they fire Gentry, then yeah, he's probably going to be like, you know what? I'm living through another crappy season. They just fired Gentry. Hey, agent man, call them up and tell them I want traded.
Yeah, that's the take that I've been most surprised by, that I've seen a lot of people say, is, well, you give them a chance and then things aren't going well in January next year, then you fire him. I'm like, and then what? Bring in some interim coach who will be way over his head and then have another lost season? Like,
No, to me, if there's even a thought that he's not the right guy, and it's as clear as it is to me, like, again, when you say fire somebody, it just has such a negative connotation, like they've done something terrible and they're a bad person. Just think of it as you have no coach and you're hiring somebody. And if you do that, it becomes so clear that you would not hire Alvin Gentry. So then, yeah, logistically, you have to fire him. But people just have to retrain their brains how to think. I know Michael Lewis did something on Daryl Morey, and I'm sure you've heard about this in one of the chapters on the pods that you listen to. But basically, it was all this, should we trade Kyle Lowry for this pick? And they went back and forth. And then they said, well, if we had the pick, would we trade it for Kyle Lowry? And they were like, well, no. And then that was the key to unlocking the whole puzzle. And it's just human beings are so dumb and limited in their scope. But I'm trying to train people on this podcast how to think way more clearly. And if you just think of it, you have no coach, and who would you hire? It becomes such a simple decision that I think you could get out of all the minutia.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same conversation that I believe it was Arnovitz on one of the podcasts. I think it was Zach Lowe, when they were talking about Magic Johnson being the new head of the Lakers basketball operations. And he was like, well, you know, he's not arguing that Magic Johnson's going to be bad, but if you want to go out and you want to hire the best possible executive and you aren't the Lakers, how many of those other 29 teams has Magic Johnson as one of their top 10 options to run their operations? Probably none.
Right.
Which probably means that maybe this isn't the right guy.
Yeah.
I mean, unless all you want is a figurehead. But we're talking about a different thing here with the coach. He can't be just a figurehead, right, unless you think Ehrman's amazing.
And I honestly don't think that Gentry is a bad coach. Like,
I don't think he's a good coach. I think he's a fine coach.
But I think that's what 98% of coaches are. Like, if you put Gentry in Houston, I think he's doing something pretty similar to what D'Antoni did this year. So, yeah. I mean, but again, this is just not the roster that you would hire him for. So that's all I'm saying. And maybe you could fit a square peg into a round hole, and Gentry, you know, starts to see that we've got to play a little different. And he's obviously a smart enough guy. He knows more about every brand of basketball than you and I combined and everybody listening on this podcast. So maybe it's possible, but why wouldn't you just get somebody who that's their natural inclination of how they want to play, rather than somebody fighting their natural inclination and, you know, playing left-handed, so to speak? So, you know, that's my only thing, but I'm looking at this and I think a lot of things are going to get better. I think you see little hints at, you know, people starting to get more comfortable. I mean, the first couple of games, guys like Solomon Hill, Jrue Holiday, and Dante Cunningham were afraid to even shoot the ball. I mean, heck, afraid to touch the ball half the time. And now they're back, you know, getting into their feel of, okay, you know, I'm just going to play my game and not worry about the fact that we have these two superstars we have to feed all the time. So you could see things improving a little bit, but again, this team is going to go, just like any team, as its stars go, and its stars are not in the type of system that would eventually be best for them. So that's just all that's clear to me, is that this team has to play far slower to maximize what it has at its roster, and I just don't know if they'll ever do that.
Yeah. Let's talk about that Hornets game for a little bit, just in specifics. I don't think that anything more beneficial to the Pelicans could have happened than Kemba Walker deciding he was the shiznit at the end of that game. He hits a couple threes, and suddenly that's all he's going to do is jack threes. He went 4 of 15 from 3 in that game, and people will remember that he hit a couple big threes, but you forget the fact that he misses like four in a row at two different points in the fourth quarter and the overtime. And when he misses them, it's not like he's catching and shooting. It wasn't somebody set it up. He caught the ball and he missed. It was, he just ran up court, caught a screen, or maybe didn't catch a screen if he didn't feel like it, and he just jacked up a three. It was really bad basketball.
Yeah, I mean, but it was a tough game in which a lot of guys played a lot of minutes, and they were on the second night of a back-to-back.
It's true, and they were tired, and you could see Batum's legs kind of left him, because early in the game, he was operating and just picking our team apart. He could be switched on to almost anybody and give them fits. But at the end of the game, his jumpers all started going short.
Yeah.
But they stopped going to him too, and Kemba started being hero ball. So thank you, Kemba.
Yeah, I think everybody. I mean, they basically had three guys they could get the ball to in that game, and I think by the end of the game, everybody was worn down. So Kemba just had the ability to get his shot off. So they kind of went there, and you know, Anthony Davis's wrist injury was probably a bit of a blessing in disguise, because he looked like Russell Westbrook at the end of the game. Like, he just had 10 times more energy than anybody else on the floor. And, you know, that was able to carry him to a victory. But, you know, that's the thing, is you're playing Charlotte on the second night of a back-to-back. Their guys, you know, essentially their legs are dead by the second half. And then you still have to get an A-plus game from Anthony Davis, and then three out-of-body experience games from Solomon Hill and Dante Cunningham and Jordan Crawford, just to win by a bucket in overtime. So to me, that, you know, I guess the end of the season, I don't care about the playoffs. I don't care about the top three pick. I can't control it, either of those things. The goal for every game should be to be learning and, you know, getting these guys play together more and play better. I don't know how much of that is going on, though. The way that it seemed that they won this game was that they played the same way that they did prior to the All-Star break, where it was just four out and Anthony Davis, and a couple of those guys ended up hitting shots. And if you're talking about the long term of how this team wins and at a higher level, I mean, it obviously can't be that way if Cousins is such a big part of your team. So this one, to me, kind of felt like a win that really didn't teach us anything or help us with the bigger picture and the process. Do you agree with that or no?
Right. So I will agree with that. So here's just, I'll give you what I walked away from that was good in the game and what I walked away from that was bad in the game for me. And so good. And I'm not going to do any fluky things. Like, obviously, you know, Crawford hitting 5 of 7 threes, that was good. Like, whatever. What I want to say, what I saw that I could see this team doing again next year and I thought was good. So first off, there was actually a couple Anthony Davis, DeMarcus Cousins pick and rolls, and they actually got reversed, where sometimes it's Davis doing the screen and sometimes it was Cousins. Every time they did that, they got a good shot. Every single time. They didn't make very many of them, but they got good shots for themselves and their teammates, which is huge. Like, just knowing that they can operate that way. How many big men can actually guard a big man who's dribbling and attacking and know how to respond when another big man is setting the screen? There's not a whole lot that are familiar with that scenario. So I'm not saying that should be like a steady diet of that kind of pick and roll, because eventually they're going to figure it out. They're going to send guys over and they're going to dig turnovers out of you left and right. But if you could pop that out 5-7 times a game, you're going to get yourself some easier buckets, and it's going to be pretty nice. Cousins, and this, I do really like what he does down in the paint, because even when he's just flailing, he doesn't really have a chance, he is still occupying the attention of two guys on the other team at all times. There are always two guys smashing into him, pushing him, you know, trying to get him out of from under the basket for a rebound. So if this team ever manages to find a small forward that could actually swoop in and grab a rebound, this team suddenly rockets into the top in rebounding. Because Cousins is going to have two people. Davis is going to be on one side. The small forward will be on the other. And one of these guys is going to grab that rebound almost every time. It's just going to be such a big bonus to this team. Now, switching this and going to the bad side, Cousins, when he starts getting pushed around, he seems to like to stick his forearm in people's faces all the time. And I am willing to guarantee 100% that the reason why we didn't see as many free throws as we probably should in that game was because every time somebody was pushing and hitting Cousins in ways that were questionable and would probably eventually draw a foul, Cousins responded in such a way where the ref was like, oh, God, I can't call a foul now. Because Cousins just hit that guy in the face with his forearm. And there he's like, this is everything here is questionable. I don't want to be calling double fouls all the time. And they just swallow the whistle. And in that situation, they're just going to let it play. And then the very last thing, and this goes to your big thing that you haven't liked, which is fit for system for Cousins and Davis and everything, is the thing I have always, and I also feel a little bad for Cousins about this, the thing I always hated about our team's offense all year long, there is nothing worse than an Anthony Davis classic post-up. When Anthony Davis would come out to the post position about a step or two out of the paint on the left block, and they would you know, sometimes manage to get the ball into him. Usually they'd get the ball into him. And then the guard would clear, and then he would turn and face. Because that is the most predictable, boring, obvious thing to contest in the game. I hate the classic post-up now. You can send people from anywhere on the floor at any time. And that's pretty much all they're giving Cousins at this point. If either Cousins is catching on the three-point line and saying, having to make a decision, which is not ideal for a big man, no matter how good of a dribbler he may be, quote-unquote, for a big man, you can't drive from the three-point line and score easily if you're 7 feet tall. Or you're giving him the most classic, boring possible kind of play in the game. It's terrible. Like, name one time you can think of where Cousins had an easy catch down low.
Yeah,
they don't run anything for
Yeah,
him.
And even the guys who do throw the entry pass. I mean, we don't really have many guys who seemingly know how to throw in a pass into the post. Even if they do set something like that up.
Yeah, and so when somebody said DeMarcus Cousins was coming to the team, you know what the first thing I thought of? Him sitting in the pinch post position at the elbow, the spot where basically everybody wheels around that one thing. You do down screens, you get the ball to Cousins there because he's actually a really skilled passer. So you get him the ball up there where they're not going to fight so hard for the position because it's not a deadly. It's what they do. Marc Gasol takes that position all the time, and then he flips passes. Everybody cuts around him. I can't remember him ever catching the ball there except for a few early on possessions, like in the first quarter, for like, you know, they try it once, they try it and maybe a second time, and then they give up on it. Then they go back to the other stuff. It's just. Anyways.
Yeah, and I mean, I think even with some of the best minds, there's just too much going on right now, and I think this could kind of bring us to what I think was kind of the highlight of the week if you're a Pelicans fan, and that was a podcast that some Bourbon Street Shots writers did with one of the Pelicans assistant. I mean, it was a really smart podcast and a great interview, and you know, I think inside of it there's so many things to unpack, but I would just be curious as kind of what your takeaways from it was, or you know, if you've been seeing any of these recent games through different eyes after listening to that. Or
you guys should listen to the podcast. It's called the Pelicast. It's their episode 5. And it's Kumar interviewing Jamel McMillan, the assistant coach. He goes through basically everything that an assistant coach has to do, including, you know, planning for teams, the guys that he has that were his guys that he worked with every day, and worked them out. And there's like, there's a whole list of things that he goes through. The one overarching, very obvious thing is it's the whole, like, it's not just the guys who, you know, it's not just DeMarcus Cousins. We have almost all brand new guys doing entirely different roles and having to be trained to do new things. And this is something he talked about a lot, just to do stuff like in reactions. Like when people talk about like good martial artists and stuff like that, these guys have done the same action thousands of times repeatedly in practice, and that's so they go to it so fast compared to everybody else because their body's just trained to do it. And these guys have been playing together for 5 games, and they're expected to do completely different things than A, they used to, or B, with brand new teammates because they're new. Like half the team is I don't know, half the team's a bit much, but what, 25% of the minutes being played by this team are by new guys or guys who are completely unfamiliar with at least two of the people who they're playing with. I don't know. What did you pick out of that?
I mean, the main thing that I took away is just, you know, I know you've kind of made fun of me in the past before saying it, of like saying how these people are so smart, but this is kind of, you know, what I was talking about is, you see the average fan on a message board or on Twitter, and they're like, you know, why don't they just teach these guys to shoot from the corner more instead of shooting 18 footers? Or, you know, why doesn't that guy just take a bunch of jumpers after practice and he'll fix it? Whatever. Like the fans who think they're so smart that think that they have the solution, I hope they listen to that podcast and realize that everything you think the coaches should be telling them to do or that the players should be working on, they're doing that plus 10 more things that your casual dumb fan butt has never thought of. So it's so pointless to me when fan or even you and I go off and say what should be being done, because literally every single thing we've thought of has been thought of by them, tried to execute by them, and then 10 times more things that you and I haven't even thought of. Like, yeah, you know, you've been saying for years, why doesn't Jason Smith just take a couple steps back? And of course, that's what coaches wanted to do with Cunningham, and then they go a level beyond that of, okay, based on our sets, you're going to actually practice from here and here, but not so much there. And then why are you doing well here, but not there? Oh, it's because when you shoot from this corner, because of that angle, you actually shoot it three different ways, and we're going to work on the foot placement and this and that. Like every single little thing that a fan or you and I think that we know and is just a little quick fix and, hey, you know, I pulled up these stats on basketballreference.com or Synergy, and if the coaching staff only knew this, they would play these lineups or do that. Like, I hope people listen to that and humble themselves that every idea your little microscopic brain has ever had, that staff has thought of that and then 10 times beyond that level and act like you've got the answer that nobody else has thought of because they're way smarter than you and way more detailed than you. That was my takeaway.
Yeah, they still shouldn't post it for Marcus
Cousins that way. But beyond that, that's where I'm saying people all get on the coaches, and what have I been saying for years? I've been saying it's a basketball IQ thing because there was one thing that McMillan said in there that I don't think he meant it in a snarky way, but I kind of chuckled, and he was like, he was talking about, like, you heard him be able to spit off not only the Charlotte game, which he had just planned for, but it was obvious that he had scouted the Clippers game and Utah, because he was spouting off every single tendency of Kemba Walker, Gordon Hayward, and J.J. Redick.
Yeah.
just from top of the head, he was spouting off every tendency. And there's a little part in there he goes, yeah, and I could tell Drew all that stuff, but Drew's not going to remember. And he didn't mean it to sound like the way I had it. But my entire point is people are always like, oh, Gentry out of timeout, or why doesn't, you know, the coach tell him to guard the left hand? Those coaches know every single little tendency of the opposing players and have told him 35 times, don't leave that guy, or when he goes left, he's going to do that, or when Valanciunas catches it, he's going to do that stupid pump fake. They have told every single one of the players multiple times. It's the players who lack the IQ and aren't able to retain that information or use it in the actual moment. And the teams that win time and time and time and time again are full of high IQ players, because all the coaches in the league are about the same, and they're distilling the same amount of information to their players. But LeBron James could tell you everything about every player. Chris Paul is a human walking encyclopedia, so he knows everything about every player. Same with some of the Golden State guys. This team has been devoid of high IQ players for the longest time, and they still don't have any right now. So,
yeah. I would say that while I agree with you that, you know, you can just listen to the podcast, and you're absolutely right, the amount of knowledge that one of these assistant coaches, Jamel McMillan, shows in that that, you know, hour long podcast makes it very clear that yes, they know all these nitty gritty things and better than probably most people do, without any question. It's their job. That's what they're requested to do. And these guys don't work like, you know, 40-hour weeks. They're doing this for 80 hours a week. They're doing it. They're traveling. They're doing this all the time. I will say, though, that I think that certain coaches, and I think is what you're trying to say before, they have their systems. Then they're not going to say, hey, Dante Cunningham, you know, we want you to now learn XYZ that's different from what he's doing now, because he's doing what they want him to do right now. And they're going to come in, they're going to stall their system, and they're going to say, Dante Cunningham, here are your five things that you're supposed to do all the time. And, hey, Boogie, here are the five things we're going to try to run for you all the time. And if you listen to, like, the interviews that, like, Zach Lowe has with, like, DeMar DeRozan and other players, they come in and they'll even say stuff like, oh, we already know all the plays they're going to run. Even the players will say that. We know all the plays they're going to run. We just have to execute on it. So really, it's just training, and it's what does your staff decide are the five things they're just going to drill someone at and say, these are the five things you have to nail down to be able to make our system execute. And that's the real limitation up for these coaches, is I have training camp. I'm going to get each of these guys to be good at five different things, and those five things are going to be really good at, and they're going to focus on them. And every practice, I'm going to have them drilling that kind of thing. And I think that Gentry's five items for every player would overlap on two of them with another coach. And so it's really which of those five items you want. That's an oversimplification saying five items, but that's the general idea. So while I think that, yeah, they might have thought of all of them, I don't know if I would say that they consider all of them. That was where my entire take was going.
Yeah, no, I get that, and that's where coaches, you know, kind of want to play the way that they want to play, and then if the players don't fit into it, it's just hard to execute. And yeah, I completely get that, but even when McMillan was talking about the things that he was working on his specific guys with, I was nodding my head like, yeah, those are the things you should be working on those guys with specifically. So that made a lot of sense to me. The other thing that I found interesting is, you know, basically Kumar asked him, well, how big of an adjustment has this been, not only for AD and Cousins, but for everybody? And McMillan was just like, it's been a monumental adjustment where certain guys have learned to play, you know, completely from scratch again, like Drew. But then he said, and it just by the tone of his voice, and you know, he had a pretty steady tone, so not much change throughout it. But it seemed like he kind of lamented the fact when he got to the big guys and he said, you know, and to top it all off, these are two big guys who like to play out on the perimeter. You know, they don't want to go in the post. They're not a Dwight Howard who will just pick and roll to the basket every time. And, you know, that's the last question for me is, let's say they do let Gentry go and then they go and seek out a guy who wants to play more slow down, post up, you know, post and cut basketball. Do these guys, I mean, a player's going to do what his coach wants to do to some extent, but there's a difference between being enthusiastic about it and then just doing it because you're told. Because usually what happens in the latter case is that when things start getting wrong, the player goes, well, F this. It's not working anyway. I'm just going to do what I want to do. And that's kind of the danger in that. I guess I just wonder, in your opinion, if let's say they went and got a coach like a, you know, I've been banging the table for Ettore Messina, who believes that you get ball movement by getting the ball into the mid or low post and swinging it around and playing it off it, like he would be the perfect guy, in my opinion. But my one hang up is, you know, I saw the Cavs with David Blatt, and I know it's a different situation and a different European coach. But, you know, I truly wonder if AD and Boogie like being on the outside that much. If a coach came in who did install the system that seemingly all of us want the Pelicans to play with, do you think that not would they do it or not, but they would 100% buy in and be enthusiastic about playing that way?
No, so I'm not going to sugarcoat this. I think that they will float and take some other shots, but really all you can do as a coach is drive them to do more of what you feel they should be doing. And I think both of these guys want to win enough, and they are good enough at the things that they're going to be asked to do that they will be able to do it the majority of the time. And, you know, and here's the other piece. Neither of them are going to murder you if they do what they want to do four or five times a game. Like, Davis and Boogie, if they take three-pointers or long twos, both of them are actually pretty good for NBA-wise taking those shots. So maybe they're going to take a few of those that you don't want them to take, and you're just going to have to, you know, bear it and move on and just drive them and remind them, keep getting inside. And, you know, that's just true about every single player out there who has to do harder things. Like, you know, the stuff that Curry gets to do is kind of fun, but there are always things that, you know, the entire idea of a defense is to make someone feel uncomfortable and make them work in different ways. And the idea is if you can make them uncomfortable, they'll start doing the dumb things. And I think the Pelicans have players that are disciplined enough that they're going to do the right thing enough. And even when they do the dumb things, at least star-wise, it's not going to murder them.
Okay.
You disagree?
No. I mean, I guess all of this comes down to what level of winning, you know, we're setting the bar at. Because I think even with Gentry next year, a full training camp and a roster that brings back, you know, at 80% of its rotation minutes, I'm trying to think, if they add a quasi-starter and an eighth man, what would that be? That would be like probably swapping out 40 to 50 minutes out of 240. So yeah, they bring back 75 to 80% of their minutes from this year, get a full training camp where hopefully the whole team doesn't pull their quad and need knee surgery. Then, you know,
that'd be a change of pace.
But I mean, even with Gentry, and they even want to be a top 10 pace team and, you know, whatever, but they get that training camp and they get some continuity. I still think this is a, you know, they'd be a 44 to 50 win team, with relatively, you know, average injury luck. So, you know, are you happy with that? Would you be fine? You know, whatever, probably. I guess it just all comes down to the level of winning where, you know, we talking about having the highest possible ceiling. But I still think even if they just run it back next year and bank on continuity, and that's another thing you take from the McMillan podcast is like, I'm able to be so cold sitting here on the outside, but McMillan's working with Cunningham every day. And you just hear it in his voice that he really thinks he's going to get that corner where Cunningham struggles. They're going to get that shot figured out. So now when the team.
Oh, he has pride in what they've done with Dominic.
Right. And he thinks he's going to keep improving it. So when they sit in that boardroom and there's 10 or 15 men there and Dell's like, okay, well, you know, what are we thinking about doing this off season? You know, should we go out? Should we let Cunningham walk and go get this guy who none of those people in that room have ever worked with? And Jamil just raises his hands and he says, you know, we got him up to 40%. I'm working with him on that other corner. And I really think I could get him up another 2 or 3%. And he's going to be, you know, an even better shooter the more I work with him. And like, they honestly believe that and they might be right, but there's all of these little bonds that they have from working to each other that, you know, does give them a little more inside information, but also doesn't allow them to be as cold in the decision-making process as, you know, maybe we can be from the outside. And I just think that podcast was great for everybody to get, because when it's February 18th, we all jump on the trade machine and we just throw guys in there and, you know, think of them more as objects than people. But when you see that, you know, there is a coach who works every day for 20 minutes with Dante one-on-one, and he is taking pride in every single time Dante's numbers uptick just the littlest bit, you know, you could see why sometimes the decisions that are made by coaches or the team, you know, we sit here and make fun of how much this coaching staff loves Dante Cunningham, but, you know, I know you're a boss now, Ryan. You probably have a guy underneath you who doesn't have the best metrics, but he shows up every day early. He's always looking for feedback. He's trying hard. And like, you might even like that guy a little bit more than the guy with better metrics on your staff. And like, it's no different with basketball than it is in any other business. I really hope people listen to that podcast and take away things like that from it and just understand that it's a little different than it is on your trade machine. Yeah. Do you have anybody in your office like that?
Well, actually, I'm not a boss anymore. I stopped doing that because I got tired of having people show up in my office crying.
Did you have anybody like that?
I did, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I was there. There's one guy who I was extremely proud of, and he maybe may not have been delivering the best work, but he started it so low and got pretty good. Aww. So, yeah.
Okay. Another thing I wanted to talk about is I put out the fourth piece in my series this week, and it was all about the off-season possibilities. And this one was basically the option of using all or most of your cap room this off-season to bring DeMarcus's salary up to the max and then extend him off of that number. And basically, we could get into all the numbers, but I'll just tell you that DeMarcus would make more money over the next 4 years doing that than waiting to get to free agency and then signing a max at that point. So, you know, that's the money part. And let's just say that Cousins tells you, yes, I will sign that, and then you will have him locked up for at least a guaranteed 4 more years. And the cost of doing that is you obviously got to operate under the cap this year, which means no mid-level, no biannual. You lose your traded player exception. And basically, you're just going into the offseason with the ability to re-sign Drew, re-sign Cunningham, and then add, you know, guys with the room exception and minimum deals, and then maybe you could package some of the other players like Quincy and Ajinsa and a first round pick or two to go out and get somebody. But the theory of why you might do that is because, you know, you've got a bird in the hand right now where Cousins says, I'll put my name on that dotted line. Drew resigns also. And you've got your core three for the next 4 years and you don't have to worry about anything versus, let's say, a lot of things go wrong this upcoming year. And then Boogie ends up bolting. So, you know, I could see it either way. What would be your gut if, again, it comes the end of June and Boogie's representatives let you know that they'll sign that on July 1st, but it would limit what you would be able to do this summer?
I wouldn't do that. And I know it's probably not actually, that's a hard one. I'd go back and forth. I wouldn't do it though, because like, again, the primary thing this team needs is some quality role players. They've spent all of their money on not quality role players. They need to have. They have basically one more chance to get some quality ones. They've got to take advantage of it this summer, because the next summer they're not going to have room either. Like, they've got to do it this summer. They've got to get at least one decent guy to put out there.
But I'm asking you, if they do come to you and they say, "Yep, we'd be willing to do that. Boogie wants some stability. He wants to know where he'll be. He wants to put his roots down. We will sign that 4-year deal essentially right now." And what it's going to cost you is it's probably going to cost you this is the part that's confusing to me, because when you looked at my list of like mid-level and rotation type players, you basically threw up in your own mouth. But
so let me clarify that. It was the list of if we were operating over the cap. That list made me want to throw up in my mouth. The list, there was more names on the list of if we were operating under the cap of options that made me.
Okay, but I mean, they'll know that by draft night. So that's what I'm saying. If on draft night they try to go after a Batum, a Fournier, whatever, and they're offering up future first round picks and, you know, willing to do uneven trades, and at the end of the day they just can't get any of those guys, so then they go, all right, well, I guess our next option is just to operate over the cap and go get, you know, a mid-level guy or whatever. Or we could operate under the cap, sign Boogie to this extension, and then basically we'll be sacrificing like a Patty Mills type, but we could still get somebody with the room exception, and we could still find somebody to give us a decent rotation player for future first-round picks. So now if those are the two options after draft night, what would you say then? So that would be number one for you is operate under the cap, do some kind of an uneven trade for a guy who is a needle mover.
Yes.
Two, resign or extend Boogie. Three, operate over the cap and just get a bunch of meh rotation players to fill out the depth on this roster.
That's true.
All right.
What's your ranking?
I would put the extend Boogie third, but I would have your same first. I actually think that if this team operates over the cap and they make the right moves and you use all those resources, you use the mid-level, you use the biannual, you use the trade player exception, and then you also package a couple of your contracts with future picks, I think you could walk out with a team that, you know, has some significant depth and quality players. I think if you did the over-the-cap route right, you could add four guys, and if you hit on two or three of them, you know, that would be pretty significant for this team. So I would put that over the re-signing Boogie, just because, you know, I'm going to call his bluff. If you're right and his representatives care the most about the money, well, then I'm going to be able to give him the most of that anyway. So let me go out and put the best roster around him and, you know, buy myself another year. And then I have confidence he's going to come back anyway. So that would probably be my order.
Okay. I wanted to bring up something that was in the news this week and get your level of irritation. Omri Caspi, who they traded for, he had broke his hand. There is a rumor out there from, you know, Woj.
I love Woj. Okay.
Woj. Anyways, Woj, who says that Caspi is already notifying teams that he'll be ready, and there are teams that are interested in him. So, what level of irritated are you that the Pelicans let him go if he does, say, come back and play March 20th? He is on a roster.
So, I think there's two things to break it up into. One is this year. So, this year, you know, he obviously wouldn't have helped us all at all in this period that he's gone. And then even if he comes back by March 20th, it looks like this team is already going to be out of the playoff hunt anyway. Add another couple of days for him to get back into shape. I don't think Caspi was going to help this year. Now, people will say, well, Reggie Williams didn't help this year either. But you found a Jordan Crawford because you had enough spots to keep trying out guys and keep adding new guys and seeing who could work. So if you just say Reggie Williams, then yeah, he didn't help either. And now you're just looking at the results and saying, well, Reggie didn't help. But to me, I just see the flexibility of being able to go and sign a bunch of guys. Cause maybe in the world where they keep Caspi, then Jarrett Jack goes down and then they bring in Reggie Williams and not Jordan Crawford. So we never get to see Jordan Crawford. So just by having all these spaces, they were able to bring in Hollis and, you know, all these guys until they finally maybe found one. So this year, I think it's a wash with a small chance that actually they're going to win more games because they let Caspi go, just because it gave them a chance to maybe find a Jordan Crawford and maybe he keeps playing like this. As far as next year, I get what people are saying. Well, you know, you could have, if you operate above the cap, you have his bird rights and then yada, 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 you could re-sign him and that just gives you another guy and more depth. This is where I disagree, and you kind of hit on it the first time we talked about this concept of, and you said, well, okay, what would you pay Caspi anyway? Would you pay him much more than the minimum? And with the minimum going up to $2 million, my answer would be no, I wouldn't. And what I don't think people seem to recognize is they always look at bird rights as a positive for the team. But what bird rights actually does is it gives the player the leverage in the situation. And all I've got to do is point you to the Cleveland Cavaliers, where because they had bird rights to a guy like J.R. Smith or Amon Shumpert, they had almost no leverage in the negotiation, where they were already over the cap and those players' agents were like, well, you're over the cap anyway, so there's no reason why you have to give my client less of a contract, you know, to be able to maintain flexibility. Your flexibility's gone. And they basically held the Cavs hostage for deals that were way beyond what they should have paid them. To where, let's say the Cavs only had the mid-level exception and no bird rights on J.R. Smith, J.R. Smith would have gotten the bird level or the mid-level exception. And I just think it's a similar thing with Caspi, where if they did have his bird rights this summer, which meant that they were operating over the cap, they probably would have had to overpay him to keep him. where now, let's say they want to bring him back next year, they could go, hey, we'd love to pay you more, but all we have is the biannual, you know, take it or leave it. And then he might take it because that might be his best offer. So I don't see any advantages that the bird rights would give the Pelicans in this situation. And maybe that's just because I don't think he's that good of a player or somebody I would die to watch leave. But I could actually see a lot of disadvantages in that it basically gives Caspi the leverage in this situation. So long story short, I do not shed one tear that they made this move because I think it might actually be the best both short-term and long-term.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to add much more to that except that this is a guy who Cleveland, when they were bad, didn't want to sign him after his rookie contract. Houston threw him into the Omer Oshik trade for salary matching purposes. That's how much they thought of him. They had other people they could have done then. And the Sacramento Kings threw him into their trade, and they weren't even playing him this year. So the fascination and the love of Omri Caspi comes from one season with Sacramento where he had a PER of 13.9, and he shot okay from three. That's at age 27, so it's his prime year. That is what people have pinned there. I cannot believe that Omri Caspi was let go. He's a good player. Like, maybe he could help a little bit, but he's not a difference maker. It's the same people who got so mad when, you know, Sean Kilpatrick was not kept with the team.
Like, yeah, and honestly, I don't see a situation in which the Pelicans operate over the cap this offseason and Caspi would have actually been in the rotation starting next year. Because think about it. If they operate over the cap, then that means they're bringing back, you know, they're five starters if you count each one as a starter, and they're bringing back Cunningham. Okay, now, yeah. And Frazier as well. Now they're going to use the MLE. They're probably going to trade a future pick for another rotation player. And then they also have the TPE and the biannual. So they have all these resources now to add more players. And in my opinion, at least two to three of those guys would be perimeter guys who would get minutes over Caspi anyway. I just don't see a situation in which they would have operated over the cap and then Caspi would have been a rotation player. And then people come back to me on that with, well, he could still be our 10th or 11th man. And then I, you know, okay, you're going to pay $5 million a year for your 10th or 11th man and then just tell him to wait until somebody gets injured. Like, it just doesn't make
sense. That's worked really well.
Yeah,
with the
so, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. I see that people just see, well, this is a talented guy and we might lose him, whatever. But if you're going to operate over the cap anyway, the plan is to get guys who are much better than Caspi to fill that role. And if you're going to operate under the cap, then stop crying because the bird rights wouldn't have been applicable anyway. So either way the Pelicans operate, I don't see how Caspi would have been in the plans.
All right. Okay. By the way, I thought this is funny. If you go to the Basketball Reference, you know who one of his similar player
who?
Careers
Who's
is?
Who, Caspi's? Bostan Nakbar.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Darius Sungaila.
yeah.
Difference maker.
Yeah. So, yeah, there okay. is what it is. Hopefully there won't be any outrage, but you know there will be when he gets signed on March 26th. Just like, you know, people were outraged that we gave Terrence Ross the heave-ho. He goes and signs with Milwaukee, and I don't think he's even played a minute yet.
Terrence Jones.
Do you know who Jordan Crawford's number one similarity score is for his career? This is awesome.
Hollis Thompson. I have no idea. That must have been a different Hollis Thompson than the one we've been watching. Because holy cow, I meant to ask you this earlier. Hollis Thompson, like, is his confidence complete? Like in that Hornets game, he was taking threes and he was leaning, just hoping he'd go in. I think his confidence is shot.
Yeah, I mean, you get so few opportunities and you just put so much pressure on yourself to make them that, once they stop going in, they're just shot. And it's the opposite for Crawford. He thinks everything's going to go in. But in reality, I mean, this is the funny thing. If they were in practice or even, you know, whatever in most games, Hollis Thompson's going to outshoot Jordan Crawford every single time. But then when the sample size is this small, when the usage is this small, a couple of shots just swing it and make one guy look like a god and the other look like a scrub. So,
I mean, I think Drew posted a little clip of Hollis shooting before a game just maybe a few days ago.
Yeah.
And he was drilling him.
Yeah, but he's no instant grits. What a great nickname that is. According to Boogie,
Crawford's nickname?
He's instant grits. Yeah, which
I didn't
no self-respect in Southerner eats instant grits. Can you name the movie? Come on, My Cousin Vinny, maybe one of the top comedies ever.
Oh.
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
No way. I saw that movie once and I had no desire to watch it.
You find me many other comedies that one of the actors walk away with the best acting Oscar, and that movie's a freaking clat. That should be a movie that they remake as a television series in 2017. One of the greatest movies of all time, and definitely one of the best comedies of all time. Tweet it, Ryan, if you guys agree with me, because I know anybody who's seen it. And, you know. I know it can't compete with Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but I'll take an intelligent movie any day over slapstick crap.
Monty Python's very intelligent.
Yeah, when I was 8. All right, so we actually got four games coming this week, so let's get through them. We got Portland, who's right ahead of the Pelicans in the standing and probably the last team they'd have to jump over before they got to Denver. So they've got Portland, then they go that next night against the red hot Miami Heat with a one-eyed Goran Dragic. Then they got Houston, who has just embarrassed them both times they played this year. And then Sunday against Minnesota, who's actually been playing better of late, but we know AD is going to get up for Karl Anthony Towns. So which of those games interest you?
Honestly, the Miami one is the most interesting to me because we've seen Portland a couple times. We know what they are. We've seen Houston, and it's scary, and we know what they are. And any game where Eric Gordon might make my team feel bad and make me hate him even more is not comfortable for me. But like, I haven't seen Miami at all. I haven't watched a single Miami game, and they've won, 20 of their last 25 games?
They were 11-30 on January 13th. 11-30, and now they're 32-34. That's insane.
Wow.
Like, think about the conversations of Miami fans on January 13th. They're 11-30. They're going to have a top three pick for the first time, and who knows how long, and, you know, whatever. Should we trade Dragic and all this mess? And now they're 32-34.
Yeah. And fortunately, though, Dragic got hit in the face. And if everyone hasn't seen this, go find a picture of what Dragic looks right now. It looks like somebody, like, warped his face using, you know, Photoshop or something. His swollen eye is creepy looking. And they're hoping that he won't be playing tonight, I guess. It's tomorrow night, and they're hoping that he'll be ready for us on Wednesday. So everybody hope that swelling.
Yeah, it's gnarly, but yeah, I mean, the Heat have basically been doing it with defense, and then they've just gotten, you know, some some good enough perimeter play from their guard. I mean, Deion Waiters has basically been what we've seen from Jordan Crawford. He's just been doing that for the last 2 months, where he's just been absolutely ridiculous. Dragic was always good, you know, and then they're just getting enough from Tyler Johnson and James Johnson and guys like that. But they're mostly doing it on the defensive end, where they're a top five defense this year in the league. And, you know, they just, they're winning on that end at a kind of slower pace. I mean, a lot of it seems like, to me, what should be the Pelicans, you know, formula, and the Pelicans could theoretically do it even better than Miami's been doing it. But yeah, they have been scorching hot.
Yeah. And they're basically, they just have a bunch of interchangeable parts too on the wings. They have no names that are going to pop out of you except for Deion Waiters, and almost that's always for all negative reasons. But between Waiters and Tyler Johnson and James Johnson and Justice Winslow, who you'll probably recognize for other reasons, and Josh Richardson and even Wayne Ellington, they're all kind of the same dude. They're just all working really hard on the wings and playing great defense. And they pull out Justice Winslow and they put in James Johnson, and he
covers. Yeah, and I mean, they're all long and cover well on the perimeter, and that's why opponents, you know, the Heat are number one in opponents' three-point attempts and three-pointers made. And by number one, I mean that they allow the least of both of those. So they just basically, you know, they clamp down out there. They're not going to let you take the three-point shot that has become all the rage in the NBA. But then, you know, they also are great defensively on two-point shots, where they're third best in the league, you know, at defending that as well. So they're just, you know, they're swallowing up all of that stuff. They don't send you to the line that much. You know, they get a fair share of defensive rebounds, so you're not getting multiple chances. They're just playing really good across the board defense. And then, you know, they bank on having a hot night from a Dragic or a Waiters, or even the occasional James Johnson or Tyler Johnson go off. And then that's just enough for them to win, and they've been doing it time and time again in the streak.
Yeah, and like here's the fun part about them: Tyler Johnson, James Johnson, Deion Waiters, and Justice Winslow, and I guess I would even include Josh Richardson in his 28 minutes a game. They're all getting assists in the 2 to 4.5 range, like. They're all moving the ball. They're all making the right play. And it is just a testament to the system that Spoelstra is running with them. It's just doing a really good job.
Yeah. There. And I mean, there's teams like this. There's teams like Washington that, again, if you want to be on the hope train for the Pelicans and think it just takes time. I mean, Washington started 2-8 this year, and it just took them time. And these were teams who even had a training camp, which the Pelicans haven't had. So there's just teams all around the league that you could see the evidence of, look, it just takes time for things to come together. But then when they eventually do, you know, you have that cohesion, you really start playing well. And I said there might not be any better team in NBA history. Like, I would bet, I mean, that was exactly 41 games. They were 11-30. I will bet that they have the largest discrepancy between first half and second half of the season of any team ever, by probably a pretty wide margin. I mean, it wouldn't be nuts if they went 32-9. Can you imagine going 11-30 one half of the season and 32-9 the second half? Like, and that's on the table right now.
Yeah, and to put that into perspective, I remember when the Pistons went 40-5 the year after they won the title, and people were anointing them. They gave them 4 All-Stars. They were the best team in the league by far. I mean, this team isn't that far from that, of what they've done. Like, it's
Yeah.
It's kind of
forced. Yeah, the team that interests me, and, you know, we've kind of seen them do this last year, and I wonder if they're turning the table again or turning the corner again, is Minnesota. Like, they obviously, you know, going into the All-Star break, they look like a team that was definitely not playoff bound. And then in their last couple of games, they win by 27 at Utah. They beat the Clippers again, you know, with Chris Paul and everybody back, by 16 points. They beat the Warriors. They take San Antonio to overtime and just lose. But, you know, this team seems to be playing a lot better, and most of that is through Karl-Anthony Towns, where I do think that in some ways the LaVine injury was kind of a blessing in disguise, because he was taking a little bit too much of a backseat to him. And this team still doesn't have the depth and, you know, the number, the sheer volume of players, but they have two guys in Towns and Wiggins who could honestly go off for 35 or 40 on a given night, and a very good playmaker in Rubio. I just think they're a dangerous team, and I know the Pelicans beat them down pretty easily the last time, but, you know, I saw them kind of catch their groove last year after the All-Star break, and I just wonder if it's happening again.
Yeah. I mean, the guy who I actually give a lot of credit to for this entire stretch is Rubio. Like, the guy has just been really, really good orchestrating that team, and I know people still will get on him because he can't shoot a lick, but he's just so effective defensively and distributing the ball, and he makes everybody's life so much easier. So I don't know. It'll be an interesting game to see if the Timberwolves counter to DeMarcus Cousins is going to be, because they don't have, like, do you think Deng is going to be able to?
If Cousins sits outside the 3-point line, yeah. I mean, I'm just being honest. If he does, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But yeah, okay. No, I agree with Rubio. I mean, in this league, in this day and age, he'll never really get the props he deserves. But even in that Clippers game, you know, he defends Chris Paul all game. Chris Paul goes 3 for 9, only scores 7 points. And, you know, Rubio just brings all that defense, scores 15 points, dishes out 12 assists, 6 defensive rebounds. Like, I totally agree. Karl-Anthony Towns is a monster. Wiggins is going to get points by pure volume and getting to the line. But Rubio, you know, really on both ends of the court, has been the one who's kind of been dragging him along. And I agree. I don't think he'll ever get the credit he deserves. And whatever team has him is going to constantly be looking to move him and never quite appreciating him. But I just think he's a very good point guard that doesn't get the recognition he deserves because of where this league has kind of gone and what people seem to value.
So are you looking at the page for the
Wolves?
No. Okay. We just talked about points per shot, where DeMarcus Cousins is at about 1.26, 1.27, and Davis is at 1.3, so we know those are good numbers. What do you think Ricky Rubio's points per shot is?
I would say around 1.2.
1.287. So, yes, he can't hit a 3-point shot, but somehow, because he gets some free throws and he takes enough threes, he's actually a fairly efficient scorer.
Yeah,
he's
and
freakish.
I'm guessing I would bet his assist to turnover ratio is over 3-1, which is considered high end or elite. What is it? 3.6 to 1. Okay. Yeah. I mean,
yep.
To me, he's been a guy that I know. I read an article about him years ago when him and Kevin Love were on the same team. And the premise of the article was actually that Rubio was the more valuable player, and it's because he supplied a bunch of things that can't be replaced. And things like points, are pretty easy to replace when a player goes down, because everybody who's in the NBA, for the most part, knows how to do that and how to get buckets. And that article just made me look at Rubio much differently, and I think he's a player that has a lot of value, and I think LaVine going down has actually helped this team get a little better. I think if you replaced LaVine with just two shooters who played a role, I think this team would have been much better than this year. But since he thought he was the third triplet or another star, I think that actually held this team back a bit.
Yes, LaVine's PER for the season is 14.8.
Yeah.
And people focus on his 19 points per game.
Yeah. Yeah, no, great. Points are the easiest thing to replace. Those, that doesn't make you a valuable player. I think there's a lot of interesting games. I would honestly be happy. I would be happy with a 1-3 week if we just won that Houston game. I'm tired of them beating up on us. I'm tired of them taking 63s and Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson hitting a couple. Like, I don't care what happens this week. I would just love to win that Houston game.
So I'm hoping for 2-2. I don't care if they win in Houston or not. I want them to beat Portland because I hate Portland. Portland is, anyone who pays attention to this, Portland is a team that I hate them. And then Minnesota, I kind of like this Anthony Davis showing Karl Anthony Towns that, yeah, I'm the better player. I like that he's doing that. And I want him to keep doing it. I enjoy it. So I have that going for me until Towns actually wins the game.
All right. Yeah, I'm going to go with 3-1 this week with the one loss coming against Houston.
Wow. 3-1. Yeah, I'm going 2-2. I think they're going to, I want to go 1-3.
You want to?
I like, if I'm making a serious prediction, I'm going 1-3. I think they're going to lose that game on the back-to-back in Miami. I think they're going to lose to Houston. And I think they're going to drop one of the Portland or Minnesota games. I think those are both 50-50 contests.
Yeah. So, okay, I'm going 3-1.
All right. So thanks, everyone, for listening to In the Know.